So when we think of Alaska, obviously we think of one of the 50 states, our northernmost state, covered in snow. They only get like 2 hours of night, maybe an hour of night a year. It's a pretty serene environment, wouldn't y'all say?
I kind of imagine that it looks like Antarctica. I know it doesn't.
There's areas, but
I know it's prettier than that. But I also imagine that that terrible Josh Hartnett movie, The 30 Days of Night, and that's based in Alaska, isn't it?
Yeah, so is The Thing, so is a handful of other, you know, crazy, creepy movies. I tend to think that there is a lot of Eskimos, but like igloo Eskimos in Alaska, just because I've never been there, or penguins. But the thing that I don't think about happening in Alaska, because it's not a metropolitan area, it's not part of the contiguous 48, is mass murder. And that's where my story is going.
I think Alaska, it's got more of an eerie kind of feel to it because of how close it is to Russia. Like, it's closer to Russia than it is the U.S.
It definitely has a very creepy vibe, especially, I mean, I go back to the whole, they got like, what, a month of nighttime in it. That's dark.
Right.
I always think of that line from Alien, when it says in space, no one can hear you scream. And I feel like that's kind of probably how it is in Alaska. Like, because everybody's so spread out, you know, in Alaska, no one can hear you scream. So in 1982, the Colthurst family was making a profitable living as salmon fishermen aboard their new vessel called the Investor. The boat was impressive, 58 feet long, an estimated price of $850,000. Mark Colthurst owned the boat with his pregnant wife, Irene, their two children, Kimberly and John, and a crew of four: Chris Heyman, Dean Moon, Jerome Kwan, and Mark's cousin, Michael Stewart. Now, it's not a mystery how the Colthurst family and a group of teenage deckhands were killed on their fishing boat. What's the mystery is why and who did it. Because 35 years later, they still don't know.
So what kind of boat are we talking about again? It's like a yacht.
So this is a 58 foot long
fishing boat, right?
Salmon fishing boat.
Okay.
Called the Investor. 35 years later, this is still Alaska's worst unsolved mass homicide. And here are the five things y'all need to know about the case. One, the killer moved in plain sight. Hours after shooting his victims with what police believe to be a .22 caliber pistol or rifle, the gunman fired up the engines of the 58-foot, $850,000 Investor, waving nonchalantly to a nearby skipper as he moved the vessel, with his victims' bodies inside, to the secluded bay a mile outside of town. He motored back to the weather-beaten docks in the Investor's skiff, returning the next afternoon with a can of gasoline to set the craft ablaze before speeding back to town and then vanishing. Authorities would later describe the suspect as a white male in his early 20s with a pockmarked face.
What does that mean?
It means he had probably really bad acne.
Mm.
So he had acne scars all over his face.
Scars, right, yeah.
Got it.
Scarface. Ray Shapley, a former Craig police chief, which is the city in which the murders happened, recalled that morning saying, "When I got there to the boat, black smoke was coming out of the wheelhouse, but there was nobody on deck. It made the hair on the back of my neck stand up." Fact number two we need to think about this case. The family was celebrating just before their death. Police said Mark, who was based in Blaine, Washington, and his crew arrived in the rowdy town of Craig, Alaska on September 5th, 1982, shortly before the final days of the commercial fishing season. The ambitious, hardworking, and well-liked skipper had recently become the proud owner of one of the most expensive high-tech commercial fishing boats of his kind in the region. Every one of his crew wanted to be like Mark, recalls Keown's older brother Brian, who was one of the deckhands who was murdered. He was one of the best skippers around. Hours before his family was killed, Mark and his wife and the kids attended a birthday party thrown for him at a restaurant near the docks, returning around 9:30, just as the storm began to rage in Craig, Alaska.
See, Mark got cocky. He got cocky, started shooting his mouth off about his awesome boat that he has. That's what I think.
According to police, that's when the killer crept onto the Investor under the cloak of darkness and waited to make his move.
Were there any other You said there were some deckhands, but were there any other, like, was there an engineer for the boat? Were there any other staff on the boat?
No, just Mark, his family, and the four deckhands, who were all teenage boys.
And so he was coming on board at night, right before the storm?
They were making their way back to the boat around 9:30, right before the storm hit.
Okay. I can only imagine trying to kill people if your boat is rocking back and forth because of a storm. Mm.
The only solid leads were reports from witnesses who saw a man leave the Investor in the skiff. Townspeople also witnessed a man buying gasoline the morning of September 7th. The picture of the crime scene and the crime itself began to take shape, but finding the killer was a needle in a haystack proposition, because most people in Craig and in Alaska were young men on fishing vessels that time of year. So the man in the skiff blended in perfectly. Nothing out of the ordinary. He just looked like
so much
else.
So he was able to give somebody a friendly wave as he moved his murder boat around to the bay.
Or it was somebody that they knew. Oh. That's what I'm curious is, like, could they have known the person that killed him?
Craig is a pretty small town, I guess?
Yes. When police came onto the boat, after putting the blaze out, they realized that nobody had died from the fire itself. They had all been shot before the fire, and the fire was used to cover the crime scene. Within days, a $15,000 reward was posted, and authorities wanted to find the young man, perhaps no more than 20 years old, with an acne-scarred face, a slim build, with longish, light brown hair. As time went by, a workable theory began to take shape. Probably on September 5th, a Sunday, a man boarded the Investor after the Colthursts returned from dinner. He may have been an acquaintance or a former crew member, but most believe that the killer knew Mark or someone else on the ship. So they saw him coming onto the ship, assuming that he was known by the crew or the family. Those familiar with the case believe a fight broke out. Whoever was on board brought a .22 caliber weapon. Upon further investigation, the coroner determined that the bullets inside Mark and Irene's skulls were a .22 caliber. Once the couple was dead, the killer dispensed with everyone else. But the question really comes up is, did the killer show up with a chip on his shoulder to settle a score with Mark? Or was this just a happen chance shooting?
All right, let's go back in time just a little bit. Were they killed in their sleep? Were they awake? Like, how were they found? I guess I have a question of, like, how they were found on the boat.
They were found burnt.
Okay, but, like, were they in their separate rooms or in beds, or were they, like, all just strewn about on the deck?
Strewn about on the deck.
So how did one man overtake, what, seven people?
Well, the
with a .22 caliber.
Irene, the wife, was pregnant.
Yeah.
So probably easy to dispense of.
Right.
The two children were under eight.
But you got also four teenage deckhands. That's not some scrawny dude right there. You got four capable, burly guys that plus Mark that could have taken this guy down.
That's probably what makes this case so mysterious is he takes out, what, eight people?
Seven people.
Seven people. So now I'll say this.
No, eight people.
I'll say this. A .22 caliber pistol is not the loudest thing in the world. So, now it's only a 50-foot vessel, so they still should have heard it, but it could have sounded like anything on the ship as well.
Now, we'll say that the two children were found in their bed. The police began to hone the investigation, and they centered around one man whose name is John Peel. But that wasn't until 2 years after the incident had happened that they arrested John Peel, who once worked for Mark and who had been working on another fishing boat and claimed to be asleep at the time of the killings, and was identified based on his similarity of sketches of the suspect from witnesses. In 1986, Peel's first trial began and hinged on completely circumstantial evidence, lasting over 6 months.
Gotta love small towns.
6 months with circumstantial evidence? I feel like that would have gotten thrown out pretty quickly these days.
Prosecutors suggested that he had committed the murders because of a falling out he'd had with Mark, and it ended with a hung jury.
Now, was this vessel, was it in port, or was it...
It was in port.
Out somewhere, okay.
At the time of the burning, it was out anchored near an island.
So whoever did this took the ship out in deeper waters and lit it on fire.
And they have some knowledge of moving a vessel in water and weighing anchor and all that stuff.
I was curious when you said that the their witnesses.
Yeah, so the witnesses saw him leaving with the boat and probably returning after, but not out in the water. Because that bay, it gets extremely foggy in the morning, which is when the boat began to burn. But after being found not guilty in a retrial, 2 years later, Peel filed a wrongful prosecution suit against the state to recoup his legal fees and was awarded a reported financial settlement of $900,000.
It's more than the cost of the boat.
As of right now, police are no longer looking for the killer. The case is closed, said Tim Despain, a spokesman for the Alaska State Troopers. But the investor slayings are hardly resolved. David McNeil, who was a police detective and had helped the Alaskan authorities investigate, said that they got the right guy. Just because someone is acquitted doesn't mean they're innocent. It just means that there's not enough evidence to show guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
He sounds like a good suspect to me, but you can't. It's hard to try anybody on just circumstantial evidence.
The fact that the reason that this case caught my eye is that it's unresolved for almost 40 years. For a family, two young children, and four teenage boys.
That's an angry person. I mean, it's one thing. Like, if you got a problem with Mark, cool. Take out Mark. I mean, I'm not condoning murder. But don't go after the kids. The deckhands probably didn't do anything wrong.
Unfortunately, it's probably just collateral damage.
Just collateral. I hate that.
Yes. I think the toughest part about this is there's no way to go back and go over the crime scene again or do anything because it's sitting at the bottom of the bay off of the Prince of Wales Island up in Alaska. And it's sad to know that unless someone comes forward with a confession, that this case will remain unsolved.
It's probably why the state troopers closed it. There's no way any new evidence would come to light unless somebody confessed.
Yeah, unless somebody came forward with some firsthand knowledge of it. I'm wondering if some of the beef, maybe let's call it beef, for whatever reason this person did this. Was it fishing territory? Was it fishing related? It's just, unless you like just completely hate this entire family, what was the reasoning behind this?
That's what I'm struggling with. The motive is, I mean, I think anytime there's murder, it's probably an extreme retaliation for whatever wrongdoing you feel. But if you are a disgruntled crew member, murder, really? Like that's what you're going to go with?
And it was several years, if it was this guy, it was several years later, right? From when he actually worked on the boat?
Yeah, he was single at the time and wasn't arrested until he was already married and a father.
But how long, if Mark was the guy that did this, right? Mark, right?
Mm-hmm.
If it was Mark who did this, he used to work for this family. Mm-hmm. What was that time gap from when he stopped working to when they were killed?
It did not say. I'm looking here. The only information about Peel and Mark's background is that Peel once dated Mark's sister. They had a rocky relationship that lasted on and off for years, but the most convincing evidence was that Mark had fired Peel allegedly for drug and alcohol abuse when they worked together prior.
I could have been disgruntled.
I tell you what, circumstantial evidence, I kind of feel like maybe this is I'm not a prosecutor, I'm not a defense attorney or anything like that, but I feel like circumstantial evidence should be taken with more weight. You know what I mean? Like if it's circumstantial, well, yeah, obviously all evidence is circumstantial because it's there during the circumstance. So I understand the concept behind why that would be less credible. Circumstantial evidence is being less credible, and why, you know, a jury would have a harder time with that. But there's a hard evidence to point, but it's circumstantial. It's close enough that there's no other options. This guy looks the part. He's a disgruntled employee, ex-employee. dated part of the family, so he's got a little beef there, got fired for drug and alcohol abuse. I'd say he has pretty good motive to at least hurt Mark in some way.
Yeah.
It's all circumstantial.
So part of this, too, is the trial was in this small town, correct? Like, they didn't move it to a larger town?
I believe it was in the small town, yeah. I mean, it was held in the Ketchikan Superior Court, which I think is probably the county.
Okay. Because I'd be curious, like, the jury of his peers, if it is a small town, they may favor him some. Maybe that's why, even with the circumstantial evidence they had, that he still could have gotten off.
You get a little more nepotism in small towns like that where, yeah. You know, maybe they're...
That's why, like...
Maybe he greased a state trooper.
Right. Like, even in, like, South Georgia, some of those cases that have mm-hmm. happened down there, they've moved them to Atlanta or moved them somewhere else.
What's crazy is, just to give you an idea of how much nothing happens in Alaska, this remains the longest and most expensive trial in Alaskan history.
Wow.
From 1982.
I will say this, Alaska probably has some of that, like, Wild West type stuff that goes on, like, the law there is, I mean, you have one sheriff or something for an entire town or for an
entire... It's a frontier.
...area, yeah.
Absolutely.
This episode was written by Jeremy Thompson with discussion from Joey Thompson and Brian McIntyre and was recorded at Star Scream Studio. Grayson over at Starscream is an incredible producer and engineer, so be sure to visit starscreamstudio.com for all your tracking and recording needs. Additional audio support by Will Compton and original music composed by Nick McClure. Be sure to subscribe, and when you do, drop a line in the comments and say hi. We want to hear your grim stories too. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next episode.